The theme for the afternoon talk is a body of happiness, which I'll get to in a moment. It's vitally important that human beings, that we have a much clearer and direct access to ourselves. We need... we need rather urgently to give our whole being far more attention than what we give. That the consciousness of our species in a general way is very much pulled outwardly, particularly to the world of things and issues, and not enough access, clarity and communication with what is actually happening with ourselves. As human beings, we are suffering, and we are suffering immensely because we neglect ourselves. We've got out of touch with ourselves. But the human being, in a very simple way, is a combination of mental life, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, various states of mind, ideas, experiences, and a combination which connects and is co-joined inseparably to the physical life, the elements. And so a human being is mentality, including heart and feelings and emotions and thoughts, with materiality. And these two have an inseparable, intimate relationship, which is as close as trees to wood. What's another good analogy? Water to the ocean. The intimacy is hardly separable. And unless we give much more full and care and attention to this whole process of being human, we have frustration, anguish, and worry now, and it will certainly will increase considerably in the future if we are neglecting what it is to be human and to have access to the privilege of, in a way, the human spirit. I went the other day, the other week, I live in Totnes, it's, what do we call it, a very progressive town in the West Country of England. And there's lots of very healthy discussions going on in the coffee shops about, well, bringing down the government and other things. And a whole variety of speakers come to the town. And one of those who came, I won't mention his name, I won't embarrass him, I'd like to, but I won't, mentioned as a spiritual speaker two or three times during his talk that the universe is a benign place. Benign means the universe is a good place. The universe is kind to us. The universe is a kindly place to live there. And I listened, biting my lip, but listened. And I looked around the room, and a hall full of people, and quite a few of us in the grey-haired club, which is, my, in terms of myself, the good old days, the white-haired club, and a few of the men, of course, in the no-haired club. And others of varying ages. And I had just read a few days before, what is the biggest fear in society? This was actually in England. They did a survey. What is the biggest fear at present? And it's not so long ago that the biggest fear was cancer. People were afraid of cancer. The biggest health fear. But it's changed significantly in recent years. And the biggest fear that human beings is not so much about the body, it's about the mind, and especially dementia and Alzheimer's. And just recently, a very dear friend who I absolutely loved a bit, he had told me on a retreat in a one-to-one that his, as a man in his early 60s, he would be having a conversation, and he does really wonderful and precious, precious work, and there would be a sudden momentary pause, and the next word or two wouldn't come. And then there'd be a break for a moment or two, and then it would come. And at first he thought, well, perhaps he's tired, a bit stressed out, etc. But even when feeling quite happy and stress-free and in good spirits, that it would still happen. He went to see his physician, who recommended that he spent 3 or 4 days in hospital, and they would give him thorough tests. And the consequence of that was that the diagnosis, this is a man of 62 years of age, was he had, to his incredible shock, early stages of Alzheimer. And he then contacted me, we had some email contact. What I noticed, and with others, you know, often of course of an older age group, that they understandably can arise inside the person with this widespread fear of dementia and Alzheimer's, an understandable feeling of desperation, of helplessness, and in fact being completely subjected as a kind of victim to one's genetic makeup. That there is nothing I can do. This is in some kind of process with me, and therefore I'm helpless, and maybe the pharmaceutical industry would be able to find some solution, which it won't. At the very best, to slow down. He asked me what my view from a kind of Dharma kind of perspective, and I have to say here, at the moment the body of happiness, I know it's far away. We'll get there this afternoon. And he asked me what my view was. And the traditional analysis, yeah, would be an elemental view. And where there is some exaggeration, shall we say, or some intensification taking place, in this case, in the brain cells, in which some of the impact of that is memory, forgetfulness, some difficulty with recollecting what is near, or what is far, or the formation of language, when there is some difficulty. The material element, the hard element, the earth element, has got, so to speak, an exaggerated place. And it's not to say that there is any real solution to all of this. But I would say one thing is important here. The balance of the elements is vital. And what I have in mind here, in the old analysis, which I think is a useful one, there is the earth element, the air element, the heat element, and the water element. And if human beings are not exercising our spirit and our energy and our vitality, there will be a heaviness which will begin to set in. That heaviness may show itself in weight, and not much signs of it here compared when I used to go to the US and some places in Europe. The tragedy of the obesity epidemic and all the consequences of that. But for us, reasonably blessed in this area, are we, earth element, yes, are we bringing enough air element to the brain? Is there enough oxygen being moving daily, and I mean daily, through the body, through the cells of the body, which helps to oxygenate the brain? If we are not, we may be storing up trouble for ourselves. Is there enough opportunity for the heat element? And I don't mean what's out there. Which sometimes in England we ask, we see something blue up above us. Huge public debates take place. There's something blue up there. What is it? Two or three more generations in England would be evolved with an umbrella in our hand. So, again, sometimes the body, the physical life, it requires heat. And with the heat that comes, that heat and that warm helps to soften up the material world. It helps to change it. And similarly with the water element, we know if the ground isn't watered, it goes hard. We are elements as well. If we're not taking in enough water, liquid element, and bringing that into on a daily basis, in our daily life, would it be surprising that the body gets harder? Would it be surprising that the brain cells get harder? Would it be surprising that we start to get forgetful? We're not as clear as we used to be. And then the pharmaceutical industry says, oh, it's your genetic makeup. It's your family background. It's your history. And then you and I feel stuck. We feel paralyzed. We feel trapped. But we have consciousness. We can recognize the condition of the human being. We can bring more oxygen and air through a variety of exercises. We can expand out the body through the yogas and practices of life. We can take in more liquids to help nourish the cells and nourish the brain cells. Perhaps you and I can do a great deal and make a great contribution towards a much more clear life right to the last breath. We're not helpless creatures. We've got consciousness, but we're not using it fully enough. I had rather a nice personal story telling Sandy when she came to Totnes recently. It's a nice personal story, but a little bit of it. But sad part of it, my dear mother, who was 94, just coming up to her 95th birthday, died on March the 18th. And she, when she was 78, she decided to emigrate to Australia from England. Said here before in the hall here, it might have been to get away from me. I mean, seems a long way to go, but anyway. but my sister lived in Australia for more than 30 years. She was married to a guy who worked for Qantas, the airline, so they ended up in Australia. So my mum decided to go and live nearby. On the evening before she died, she was just 2 weeks off the 95th birthday, she said to my sister, "Let's go to the cinema next week. There's a film I want to see." She lived in a home for the aged. And then she said, "Oh, my birthday is coming up in 2 weeks' time. I'll make a cake for the staff and for the other residents." And my mother, who absolutely loved her independence, equally, bless her, loved being in a home for the aged because she just loves talking and chatting and with lots of people in there with dementia. And, you know, she had lots of nice conversations. It's a very sweet place. I used to enjoy it there. And the following morning, at 8 o'clock in the morning, she asked one of the staff people to come for a morning cup of tea. You know, it's a kind of secular equivalent of Holy Communion. And so she said to the person on the staff, "Could you pop out and get me a cup of tea?" And then my mum said, "I'm ready to die." The staff person went out of her room, put the kettle on, came back, and she'd gone.
Wow.
And, of course, you know, it's one's mum, and one loves her, and all the appreciation and the memory and the gratitude was there. But as I just heard in the front row there, so I just said, "Wow." And kind of pleased and happy that she could make such a transition. But to her credit, she had lots of good spirit and good humour about her. And she used to fly regularly before she emigrated to Australia. And I said to her, "Mum, you're in your 70s. This was before she emigrated. She said, "Don't you find it's a long flight, 24 hours, you know, from London to Brisbane? It's not an easy flight." She said, "Oh, no, I love the long flight. It could be longer for me." She said, "There are so many interesting people to talk to." No wonder the pilots lock the door these days. So I think we, with the consciousness that we have and the precious element of consciousness, of course hereditary factors are important. Of course there are genetic influences. But we're not helpless. And if we, in our, as I said, human spirit, in our aliveness, and really find that, particularly through the outdoors, particularly through air and water and heat, that surely will bring immense benefits. So then not only can we live gracefully, but equally, of course, we can pass from this world as clearly and as gracefully as possible as well. And even for those, and for the many, who in the endurance of this long old age that some people have, to me it's still an important aspect of exploration. It is something which you and I, sooner or later, will have to face. And therefore, looking at life, looking at the body, it's not only looking at life, but looking at our relationship of life to death. And sometimes, of course, it is family members, and it is loved ones, with sickness, with dementia, with Alzheimer's, and much, much else. Such people need our love fully. They need our presence. They need our support. The beginning of life needs great support and equally does at the end of it. And such people need to be part of the priority of human beings. To live this life, to bring to this life a real care and concern for the condition of the human body and the condition of the human mind. It needs to be a major, major priority. In the instructions today, and the exploration of the instructions there, I would like to expand a little bit more on some of the key words there. And in this much loved discourse of the Buddha, there is immediate reference to knowing, this is one of the key words, knowing when mindfulness is breathing in long, breathing out long, breathing out short, breathing in short, to really know, this is the key word here, to know in a very simple way and clear way what is going on, to be clear about it. It functions as a training for the mind, in this case, to know the condition of the breath. Not just for the value of that, but also to train the mind to be focused where there are other areas of life which you and I really need to focus on. That sometimes our thought reminds us, I need to focus on this, whatever it might be. It might be diet. It might be exercise, it might be the nature and the outdoors, it might be a relationship, it might be doing things more gently and lovingly. That some thought arises and the thought says, I know that I need to do this, whatever it might be. The training of the mind in the mindfulness here, there is the making of the contact with the breath and knowing, it's not easy, is the breath long or is it short? Is it deep or is it shallow? Can we as a human being stay rather steady in the contact with the breath? I agree, there's nothing very interesting in the breath. It's not exactly a thrill a minute, is it? There. And when some people have said to me on retreats in the bath, I just don't get it. I can't see the point in putting attention on the breath. The body just breathes in, it breathes out. Why bother? So I have said, if you look around the retreat center, you might find a bucket of water. Stick your head in it. I guarantee, I promise, the interest in the breath will be incredibly strong after a minute or two. And some have got, haven't believed me, I said, just see from your own experience. You don't trust me, right? All right. So sometimes we take out of this vast universe of things that we can give attention to, we take one, very close, with us as long as we live, called the breath. We place the attention on the breath. We want to know and be clear. As a human being, I am breathing in and I am breathing out. I am breathing in, I am breathing out. I'm as clear as I can be if the breath is long, in breath and out breath, if it's a short in and out breath, or somewhere in between. And there is a quiet bringing of the attention back to the breath there. That, this establishing there, does not mean that a person sitting on the meditation cushion will be able to be with the breath, every breath from the beginning through to end. But it is worthwhile, when reaching the end of a meditation, just to look back. Because knowing is important. Knowing what was going on in my life in the past half an hour. It means hardly long, even. Not talking 10 years, you know, we're talking 30. What was the last half an hour about in my life? And just to be clear as possible, was the general sense, the experience of breathing in and breathing out, was the general sense, could be, I didn't sleep very well last night, I was really, really tired there, I closed my eyes, and my head was swinging backwards and forwards, and I nearly ended up sleeping on the back of the person in front of me, which has happened. Was in the sitting some pressure that was taking place? And everywhere else on the planet seemed to be more preferable than being here. And the only comparison that one could make between here and somewhere else was between here and Guantanamo Bay. And then the thoughts are arising in the middle of the sitting. The famous 3,000-year-old mantra of many meditators, far more popular than Om Mani Padme Hum. And this one mantra is, what am I doing here? And this mantra repeats itself through the sitting there. One finds oneself more able to concentrate on this particular mantra than on the breath. All right. So we come to the end of the sitting. We look quietly back over the sitting to know what is going on with us. Not to judge, not to put it down, but to be, that's easy, just to be as clear as possible. Is it about energy? Is it about connection? Is it about pain? Is it about focus? Is it about lots of a story running through? And in this small but rather important way, we are keeping in touch, because this is our inner life. We may not approve of what's going on, but it's what's going on. And this we want to be clear, we want to know about. Just know this is what's happening. Yeah. The key here, with regard to the knowing, is that the knowing, the awareness, the mindfulness, is quite often the first step to going deeper, to understanding. I must know what's going on. Some experiences in life may arise and touch us very, very deeply, and sometimes it really is hard to know what those experiences are, which touch us very, very deeply, and in some remarkable way, something in the being, in the consciousness, remembers for a long time. And it can happen, and it does happen, that in the course of the day, something touches one. It could be a very joyful and happy experience from the past. It could be a painful or difficult one. Generally speaking, if something touches us, joyful or painful or in between, in this case, from the past, it may be offering, so to speak, some more insight and understanding. When something is coming from the past for us, and particularly if it's rather strong and it's repeating itself, it could be a sign or an indication that there is something to be known and understood with this. The difficulty is that very easily the mind starts to speculate. Why has this come up? What's going on with me? What have I got to learn from this? And lots of thought begin. We need the mindfulness of the breathing to help keep us as steady as possible while remaining very receptive to what may arise. And if one senses it's something strong, not just a few thoughts, it's not just a daydream, but something quite strong is arising, and we have a certain steadiness with the mindfulness of breathing, and something strong which arises, we recognize that which is strong, we appreciate it there, and maybe enough inner space comes and something gets revealed to us for the first time. Something shows itself. As human beings, we have the capacity to hold things in a nice way, very, very deeply. I just want to give a couple of examples. And people may have different views. I have a very good friend, Peter. He lives where I live, and a few people here will know him. He's what I call a serial house sitter. And a serial house sitter is somebody who's homeless and he just sits in the various houses. Right now he's in my house in Totnes, and he dog sits and he cat sits and he rabbit sits and then he works in the local vegetarian restaurant and he plays his flute and he meditates and he dog sits and he has. This is Peter. And also, he hitchhikes. He's a hitchhiker. And he was hitchhiking from southwest England there. And I read a newspaper item. It shows the potency of the media. A lot of people stop hitchhiking and people stop picking up hitchhikers because they've watched horror movies. And then that image stops people from either picking them up or from hitchhiking. So, he was hitchhiking up to his sister's in Liverpool. A rather famous band came from Liverpool, I forget their name. And one person, I thought was rather touching, and this is to say, the view can be different. And he, speaking to this woman, she was in her early 60s, and she said, 20 years ago, she was a single mum, and her only daughter was killed in a car crash, and in this car crash that took place, the driver was on drugs and lost control of the car and she died. And it must be at least 150 kilometres, maybe 200, from her home to Bolton. This is the town near Liverpool there. And once a month, every month, she told Peter, for 20 years, she drives to the cemetery, she takes the flowers, and spends some time at the cemetery, and at the grave of her daughter, and gives the flowers. And Peter, in his conversation with her, and talking with one or two other people, one can get different responses. One could get, I don't agree with it, the kind of Buddhist response. And the Buddhist response is, well, this happened 20 years ago, it's time to move on, she's let go, you know the language, it's so boring. And let go, and she'd move on, she's just clinging to the past, etc. If, my view here, if there is holding and clinging to the past in that way, and therefore clinging onto the memory of the daughter, one thing would be an outcome. And one can hardly imagine the blame, if not the hatred, towards this junkie, drug person high on drugs, killing her daughter. And Peter said, how do you feel about this guy who's on drugs, who killed her daughter? She said, I don't have any bad feelings. I don't have any negative feelings towards him. He has to live with what he did. It's not for me to find blame. And when I heard that there, rather than take the view, oh, she's just clinging to the past, the view I took, well, the mother loves her daughter. The mother really feels a connection, that the death has not taken away the connection. And I thought, wow, that's beautiful. So the same, I use it as an example here of love and appreciation and commitment to it, the good lady in the car there. And sometimes in these situations, that dedication to that, I think, is genuinely worthy of respect. And it's a sign of love. It's not a sign of clinging and holding on to the past. And I had a second story I want to mention, it kind of made me smile. A good friend of mine, this is in Germany, she had a lovely spiritual teacher or philosopher. And during the war, during which war did so many of them, it's World War II, he was from Holland, and when the occupation took place in Holland, he fled and went to Belgium. And in Belgium, he stayed with a family, husband and wife. He was 21, and she was 17, and as things would happen in life, she, 17-year-old, and a 21-year-old, fell madly, badly, sadly, happily in love with each other. But then, the occupation took place again, in this case, Belgium, and he fled and took another name, because the Nazis were looking for him. And when the war ended, they both tried to get in touch with each other. This is a common story, and there are a number of you from your own family tradition to know of these stories. And they couldn't, because he had changed his name. And he couldn't find her, she couldn't find him. And the years went by, and they got married, and somebody else, and they had kids. And then, not so many years ago, when he was in his early 80s, and she in her late 70s, through one thing and another, they actually got in touch with each other. It's romantic, poetic, sweet, and it's beautiful. And as soon as they met, the feelings of the 17-year-old and the 21-year-old were just as strong for the 82-year-old and the 78-year-old, that in this passage of time, nothing had changed. This feeling of the love and commitment. So my friend, who's not shy of asking the questions which would arise, said, oh, it's just so lovely and really connected and started living together and of course much to share over all these years. So she said to him, how close did you get? And he said, very close. And she said, and my friend said, not really Christian. Oh, yes. But after you'd spent some time together, one night, she came into my bedroom and got into bed with me. He said, and really close? Yes. And then he said, are you asking if we went the whole way? You understand. Oh, yes. And I thought that was just cool. That sometimes there is love and there is passion in life and deep connection, and some getting on to some 60 years could go by. And what is it in the human spirit that retains something so deep and exactly the same is retained with the other, and they're really, really connected? I thought it was just lovely. I told a teenager this. It's about his face, teenagers are like, what, 82? It's 78. Like that. And I thought to myself, when he's 80, he'll say, wow, really cool. But anyway, not at the moment. Etc. So there's the human being. There's the human spirit. Deep things of life can stay with us. The mother loves her daughter. The couple who didn't see each other for 2 years. And something happy through the body, through the being, this happiness can come. And the two, they stayed together for several years. He died first, and then she passed on. But somehow a real feeling from both of something fulfilled and the privilege, great privilege, of something coming to a completion despite the long time gap. With the meditations, giving consideration to the elements, diet and exercise, as I mentioned, posture and form, oxygen and heat, and water, and all that which nourishes mind and body because of their interconnection. There's the precious instruction taking place there of knowing that one is experiencing the whole body. Once again, it's the power of the consciousness to turn attention to the whole of the body and to really just experience it, so that the intimacy is being really well established. In that connection with the body, of course, as some of you reported in the small groups today, pain will arise. It takes a little while for the body to get used to sitting. We are not insisting in any way that one should, back to the Buddha image here, sit absolutely still. We are not made of rock. We're human. And when the meditator has these ideas, and hopefully you haven't read any Buddhist books, but if you have, I've written a few, I do apologize. But sometimes one hears these stories, people sitting, not moving, hours on end, of course they're in a coma, but or whatever. And then one gets the idea that, I should be able to sit very, very still. And then one hears of monks and other yogis taking these, what they call the aditana. Adi in the Pali, tana means station, application. And adi means higher. So higher station. Higher station means essentially sitting and making an aditana, a strong determination not to move. Foolish. It's not to move half hour, 1 hour, 2 hours, 1 week, or whatever it might be. The pressure on the person may succeed. And she or he has made the strong decision, the self, the ego, I am not going to move, I'm going to sit still, because that's what I'm here to do. The person may succeed, as I point out, but the pressure will go outside of the posture somewhere else. It has to. A common one would be in the meditator circle, oh, I'm the only serious meditator because I sit still and the others are moving. This is the only method that one can use because in this method we really sit still and the others move. So it comes out in some form of superiority feeling. That's the most common one. Mindfulness is not about control. It's about seeing what is going on, knowing what is going on in the present, but equally important, as I mentioned too, it's more than that. It's also knowing what is coming from the past into the present, like I said before. To know and be mindful of the influences that are taking place. That's why, as I said, it's helpful and useful at the end of the sitting, only take a moment, to look back over the sitting and say, what was the quality? The same principle can be applied in the walking meditation, the standing meditation, the reclining. Human beings' capacity to just reflect back so that as much as possible we're keeping in touch with ourselves. We know what is going on with ourselves. We're not ignoring. We're not rejecting or forgetting. We're being as clear as we can. If during the sitting meditation some pain arises, the breath genuinely can be a really healthy and helpful support. Therefore, the mindfulness of breathing in long, filling up the oxygen, filling up the body, and then relaxing on the outgoing breath, breathing in and relaxing. If it reaches the point or the place where it feels like it's a struggle, it's like fighting with the exercising of the willpower over, then change the posture mindfully. Move the legs, move the back, come back to the original posture. There are plenty of people, both experienced meditators and those of you who are new, may find, and we sincerely hope that takes place, that there are periods of time, at any time during the course of, this case, any of the four postures, in which one genuinely, hand on heart, feels rather relaxed. So, knowing that the body is relaxed, feeling and experiencing the relaxation of the body. When you experience that, less important to any method and technique, breathing or shape of the body, sit, walk, stand or recline, and really know, right now, in this moment or moment, not perfectly, but generally speaking and genuinely, there's a genuine feeling of relaxation of the body. One is just, in this case, just sitting quietly, feeling quite relaxed. There is no pressure on the body. There is no demand. There is no control. There is no fighting with the body. And one is just present and the relaxed sense. And letting that relaxed sense of the body be very, very, I said again, very, very, and again, very, very familiar. You get to know. This is the relaxed state of being. This is what it is to be with an upright posture and feel relaxed. This sense and this appreciation matters a great deal. We want to know this intimately in the daily life. So we're doing our practice here to give real support to us in the daily life. So just to repeat, mindfulness of the breathing in and breathing out, the noticing of that taking place, whether the breath is long or is short. Short reflection just at the end to check in how it is. When there is the sense of relaxation there, there's a certain quiet happiness of the body. Certain sense of harmony with the body. We're not fighting nor resisting, and that sense of harmony with the body allows the energies to flow more easily, and the body begins to release more happiness. It has to. It's not under pressure. It has to. We're not making demands on it. It has to, because there's a certain sense of harmony. So there's the experiencing of the body, contributing to the relaxation of the body, contributing to our happiness in life. And that happiness can be so steady with us that even if we may experience, and some may hear, pretty serious health issues, even with those health issues which are taking place, which require a lot of love and a lot of understanding and practical steps, still, nevertheless, still happiness can be felt despite the condition. May all beings live mindful lives. May all beings know the precious element of happiness. May all beings live with love.